Welcome to the WaitingForNextYear.com podcast. It's Monday morning, so I'm talking to Scott Rabb. And before we jumped on, we were talking about how electrified we were by the tribe this weekend. And you concurred. I don't want to put the word electrified in your mouth, though, Scott.
Yeah, I'm fine with electrified, Craig.
So I was about ready to tell you, I scared the crap out of my three-year-old yesterday, listening to the tribe. We had Tom Hamilton on. I was running around doing some errands, and, in the ninth inning when they tied the game, and I think Brantley singled to left and Bourne came around third and scored, and I screamed some guttural yeah or something like that, and then I turn around and I look at my three-year-old, and it was that questioning, I think a tear's about to pop out of my face. I'm looking for the next cue from you, Daddy, as to whether I should be upset or scared or both. And I was like, no, it's okay. That was a good thing. It was a good thing. You have to talk them down from weeping and crying.
It is a good thing, and it's a rare thing. I don't know. You may constantly issue, guttural exclamations, but I don't. And one of the first times I made my then infant son burst into tears, he was born in 99, God love him, and I don't remember which playoff Indians team it was, but it was one of those yes, but it was so loud. It's rare we get a chance to exult in something with a Cleveland team. It was a great series.
And I know he's missed some time, but Michael Bourne, can you just, I mean, I know they made, Reynolds has been a nice pickup and Swisher's been a nice pickup, but trying to imagine how different this season would be if they hadn't come away with that surprising, wonderful move of being able to land Michael Bourne for what many think is less than his market value. But it's still good money, of course, but, I mean, what a coup.
Okay. I don't want to place a turd in that punch bowl with love and excitement. I hope that Michael Bourne, turns out to be a coup. I think his market value was drastically less than Michael Bourne and Michael Bourne's agent felt that it was. I think it was a solid move. Please don't get me wrong. I don't think it will prove to be the crucial free agent acquisition of this past off season. I'm always happy to be wrong. There's nothing wrong with speed on the base paths. There is something wrong with thinking that you can generate it simply by stealing bases. And until Michael Bourne raises his walk rate, my own personal jury is out on Michael Bourne. I think he's a fine a center fielder. I think he's a guy that you certainly want on base in the situation that led to you terrifying your poor child. but I'm not huge on Michael Bourne as the straw that could possibly stir the Indians' drink. He's not a guy that you can simply throw bad pitches to and expect him to swing. But, he strikes out plenty. And I don't know that, he's not on the upside of his career. He's 30 years old. And I know it sounds like I'm just pissing all over poor Michael Bourne. I love what I'm seeing out of the Indians. I'm glad that Bourne's finger healed. He's back in the lineup. I'm watching every inning of every game. Can't wait to see today's doubleheader unfold. I guess don't want to get, I'm a game at a time kind of guy. I don't want to get too high or too low. So I'm sorry if I'm overreacting to your overreaction to the delight in seeing a guy who can actually score from second standing up, on a key base hit.
And I'll admit, I bought into the sales pitch. I guess I'm a bit of a rube to the Indians carny, where they said that it was bonus. They were faced with an extra opportunity to add somebody like Michael Bourne. It was something that they weren't planning on doing, something that wasn't in the financial plan. And to a large extent, I bought that, and my expectations, whether I've been beaten into tempering my expectations or whether I know it's smart business management, maybe I shouldn't care at all. I've tried to talk myself into not caring at all about the Dolan's money or the business sense of being a baseball fan. But I guess in that prism, I talked myself into the fact that Bourne was like bonus. And so now I feel like he's an extra special treat on top of the free agency. So
he is.
But you might not be wrong is my point.
I'm just saying I don't want to go from extreme to extreme, especially in baseball where things will unfold for us over the rest of May, all of June, July, August, September. All I'm asking for is a team that I can be interested in, even excited about, you know, for the next 100-plus games. And I think there's nothing wrong with being excited about Michael Bourne. There's nothing to sneeze at to have an above-average center fielder, you know, to have a guy who seems to not just be fast but smart on the bases. We haven't had that. We really haven't. I mean, Sizemore represented the kind of package that all of us could go crazy about, at least for a little while.
Not until Kenny Lofton came back in 2007 as a 40-year-old man.
It's true. And I guess my caveats really are, it's always health. Not that Bourne has anything resembling a severe injury history. He's been a full-time player and a productive player, for a while now. I guess, you know, what I worry about more than anything else is keeping the on-base average, you know, at least at 350 if he's batting leadoff. I think it's exactly there right now, making the adjustment, you know, from league to league. It is true that he was hoping for a lot more money than he got from the Indians. I think it's great. I don't even want to go to the bad Dolan place because for whatever reason they laid out the money this year. My concern with the Tribe is not Michael Bourne. It's the thinness of the starting pitching. But game by game by game, I'm not going to disallow you, me, or any other Tribe fan our right to be excited without thinking about necessarily on-base average or how you're going to make it with one or two potential top-of-the-rotation starters and the rest of them. Remains to be seen with most of these pitchers, the starters especially.
I think maybe it's because I quit playing fantasy baseball and I just don't know all the names around the league. I'm not an avid watcher of SportsCenter, so I really am Tribe focused. I will know more about the AL Central than the rest of the league. But this is kind of one of the first times in my life where I actually feel that the talent pool is really thinned out in baseball, and there's no even a concentration of starting pitching in one place where I'm just totally blown away. You see close to you over in Philly, the age is catching up with Doc Halliday and Cliff Lee and that whole staff, and it just seems like we're in one of those in between periods where talent consolidation doesn't even exist, doesn't really exist. Even out in Anaheim, where they spent all that money, it's on a bunch of guys who are a little bit older. Toronto feels the same way. They bought a really nice fantasy baseball team, but we're talking about a bunch of players that were relative failures last year in Miami. And so it remains to be seen if you could just put, you know, a bunch of guys who are used to getting paid a lot together in their 30s, in the post-steroid era, and do anything.
Well, there are. I'm just looking here at baseballreference.com. So there are only 127 games left for the Indians to play. I would suggest, not to disagree entirely with your premise, that when you look at the AL East, when you look at the AL West. I'm talking about the rosters. You look at the Tigers, and I think the NL East too, with the Braves and with the Senators. You know, I mean, there are some really good teams.
And you called them the Senators on purpose, right?
Yeah, no, I didn't. The Nationals. God, okay. You know, I actually remember the Senators.
All I remember is a baseball card with, I think, Duke Snyder. Did he play for the...
Well, he was a Brooklyn Dodger. I don't remember. You know, it's funny. The version of fantasy baseball I play is Diamond Mine Baseball, ImagineSports.com. It's a historical computer-simulated game, you know, based basically on Jamesian principles of sabermetrics.
I've actually never heard of this.
Yeah, it's really good. I mean, so for me, the Senators still exist, and so does Griffith Park. I mean, this is not a plug for Diamond Mine Baseball or Imagine Sports. It's simply the version of fantasy baseball I prefer has nothing to do with the day-to-day unfolding of the major leagues today. It has to do with assembling rosters of players, including Negro League players, Japanese players, so that you can have Satchel Paige, you know, pitching to Babe Ruth. But anyway, that's
well. And you know what's really great about that is that you don't have to care. Why should anybody care about the fifth starter on the Kansas City Royals, except in some, you know, 20 deep fantasy league that's AL only?
It's interesting though. You're right, but
we could spend our time thinking about Satchel Paige.
Well, but it also it teaches you something, or I like to feel I've learned something about team construction, about allocating money, since everyone they're you know, dweebs all over the country, mostly of ancient vintage like me, playing against each other, and you each have the same budget going into the season. There's revenue, you know, it's streams that you can alter your roster and make transactions. But part of what it teaches you is how closely related defense and pitching are. If you put a very good defense behind a below average, historically speaking, these are based on the numbers produced by actual major leaguers. They're normalized according to era, blah, blah, blah. But you put a sterling defense behind a below-average pitcher, you know, a ground ball pitcher in a ground ball park, that kind of thing, and it really does become clearer and clearer how integrated. And this, by the way, this relates to the tribe. I mean, one of the things that we saw in the Tigers series was kind of a combination of errors that just, you know, I'm sure made you want to scream loud enough to frighten the kid again. You know, because if Chisenhall can't get the throw over to Santana, Santana's no kind of first baseman. But along with that, the Indians really have assembled quite an outfield defense. They really have, and are strong up the middle. I think despite some of the metrics, I think Cabrera is a very able shortstop, sometimes spectacular. Like on that double play ball yesterday that could have easily resulted in no outs, he reached behind his body, got the poor relay, and got enough on the throw to first. Anyway, it's great to see the Indians with more than the semblance of a major league lineup. I guess part of my Michael Bourne issue is not even a Michael Bourne issue. It's a Mark Reynolds issue. To me, if there has been a huge acquisition in terms of what we've seen over the first 35 games, it's that, yeah, this guy Reynolds, he's versatile defensively, and he's not a hole at first or at third. And boy, is he a surprise to me so far with the bat. He's not the all-or-nothing 220 strikeout guy, or he's not merely that. He seems to have some bat control and some savvy and a plan when he's got a couple of strikes on him and they need a hit.
It was a real find for the Indians in free agency, because he's turned out to be everything that Indians fans were thinking they might be able to scratch out of Kevin Youkilis last year at the trade deadline.
That's great. That's a great comparison. You're right.
And so, it's funny because I'm just enjoying it. I'm enjoying watching him just be a slugger and hit monstrous home runs and contribute to the team. Some people are already worrying about the fact that he's going to be gone in an extension and everything else. Just please, you know, I can't tell anybody what to think or do, but please just forget about it. Let him drive us somewhere first.
It's tough. It's tough to be so conditioned. I am certainly to worst case scenarios, and to not enjoy. Don't ever enjoy the moment. If it's any given game, you know that they'll snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory somehow. And if they don't, let's get worried anyway. Because yeah, Reynolds is just he's only signed for this year, and it was. However things turn out, that was a nice, solid, savvy move for a team that's been moaning for a couple of seasons, at least, about a lack of right-handed hitting. This guy is just a delight to watch at the plate so far.
Yeah, absolutely. So today, the traditional doubleheader against the Yankees, you outwardly hate the Yankees as much as anybody I've ever talked to. Is there a complete history, or is it just incremental as to why you hate the Yankees so much? Does it boil down to a couple things, or is it just that incremental path?
Well, it was always there. I mean, it was there as a kid. The few games I remember my dad taking me to in Cleveland were Yankees games at a time when Cleveland was really, really competitive, talking about the late 50s. It wasn't a general New York hatred at all. I guess it was incipient in the sense of it's not genetic, but it's pretty close to that. I know I loved Mickey Mantle as a ball player. You know, there was nothing to me more appealing than the idea of this you know, switch-hitting guy fighting through his injuries. So that Yankee was all right with me. There wasn't anyone in particular that I focused any loathing on until Jeter came along, by which time, I'm not sure where I was living. I've been living in northern New Jersey since 1996, surrounded by Yankees fans, and have become friends with some. Not all of them take credit, you know, for the 27 world championships. Not all of them refer constantly to we, you know, as if they actually had something to do
right
with it. So part of what's happened, you know, the hatred exists in some platonic realm, some intellectual realm. And I've had this up-close seat since the great Joe Torre years, kind of being forced to admire the Yankees. It's kind of similar to the Steelers, except for the total lack of economic balance in baseball, which really does load up the hatred side. At the same time, it's become impossible for me not to admire the organizations. They make more than their share of mistakes because they spend more of their share of money, but they've homegrown some really enjoyable ball players. Mariano Rivera right now. I mean, I can't watch Mariano Rivera and not accept the fact that the guy, very likable and also the best, one of the best major league pitchers, period, that I've ever seen.
See, and that's funny. I was going to say the best relief pitcher I've ever seen in my entire life, and I'm probably being offensive when I qualify it that way, because you're right. I mean, in terms of dominance, in terms of longevity and effectiveness over a long period of time, I mean, I hate to sound like, you know, guy who loves the Yankees, but there's nothing not to like about Mariano Rivera.
No, and there's no way to argue. I don't think the defensive metrics a lie about Jeter's a lack of range. But, you know, all that aside, it's, you know, to not see this guy as a first ballot Hall of Famer, you know, it boiled down at one point to when they were tearing down Yankee Stadium. I had made sure that my son's first two or three Major League Baseball in-person experiences were at the Jake. I always told him he was free to find any team he wanted to root for in any sport. He wasn't born in Cleveland. But he could not, under any circumstances, become a Yankees fan. And one of the first phrases that he ever used coherently was, "Fuck Derek Jeter." But I took him to Yankee Stadium one game before they tore it down, one of the last home games the Yankees played in the old Yankee Stadium, because I didn't want to deny him the experience of seeing a Yankees game in Yankee Stadium. So I've come to grudgingly respect or accept certain aspects of their goodness, their you know, their professionalism, whatever you want to call it, while I continue to innately hate them.
Let's diverge a little bit there, because you just hit on something that I've thought about a lot since becoming a dad, and I've got a 3-year-old and you've got a 13-year-old. How do you treat, because you're a guy who's free with your language, how do you treat, you know, quote, vulgar language around your kids? And how did you have a philosophy about that when you're, you know, around him and teaching him to speak? Because I think at around 1 year old, our pediatrician said, "All right, well, it's time to start watching your mouth around the kid, because he's going to start parroting you."
I would change pediatricians. I mean, my feeling, and I've gotten in trouble with it, but it's also, I guess, one of the ways, not to sound too grandiose, one of the ways I make my living is by thinking about words a lot, obsessively. And this goes for racial slurs. It goes for vulgarities. The words exist. I have family members, people whom I respect, who, if their kid goes, "God, I hate broccoli," the parent's response is, "We don't use that word. Not broccoli. Hate."
I got in trouble. I was spoken to about the fact that my kid said "shut up."
Yeah.
And at daycare, you know, we call it, they call it a school now. Nothing could be a daycare. Nothing could be a child, you know, a place where they watch your kids. It's a school. It's a school because I think it justifies more money.
And every toy is developmental.
Yep. Right.
Rubber
and so
ball
then,
is developmental.
So I obsess about things. I'm crazy like that. So I started going through, and I knew for a fact that it was in a book. And I'm just trying to place where exactly he learned how to say "shut up." And it's the Lorax. It's the stupid it's the Lorax, Dr.
Yeah.
Seuss, okay?
Yeah.
And here I'm getting spoken to that my son said the word "shut up." And they complimented. They said he used it in context. He used it correctly.
The same way my son uses cocksucker. He knows when to deploy it and where to deploy it. Here's my general feeling about these things. We need society and we need civilization in order to live lives, you know, relatively free from all the horrors of, you know, Darwinian existence where it's dog eat dog, except it's humans eating humans. I do believe that, you know, in general, a society needs structure. I have a harder time accepting the fact that that structure tends to want to smooth and polish and shape and make rules and have thought police and word police. And I know these are abstract concepts to the child-free, but when you have a kid, suddenly these become big issues. You know, what do you call a bowel movement? When can you say "shut up" or use the word "hate"? How do you deal with you know, issues of words that are perceived as utterly forbidden? You know, no civilized person can say the N-word. No young child should hurl an F-bomb, and on and on and on. I tend to constantly err on the side of the hell with that and those rules. These words exist. They exist for a reason. They have tremendous power or not. And, you know, you teach more by modeling the behavior than by didactically imposing rules upon the child. And I've always made mistakes in the direction of, it's nice to call it free speech, but let's just call it potty mouth. That's because they're the same thing when it comes to the home situation. So I'm certainly not holding myself out as an example to anyone. It's simply some congruence between my overall philosophy of using language and my practice of using language. More is more.
I don't disagree with you. A lot of what you just said is very similar to what Kevin Smith said too. Because, you know, when he has a daughter, and he said on the record, you know, in some interview I heard, and he said, "What kind of a hypocrite would I be if I kept all that language away from my daughter when that's really how I created the entire life that I've built?" The whole, you know, he was doing dick jokes and talking about God knows what in Clerks. For me personally, I don't feel this overarching need to speak that way. I've tried to write using vulgarity in the past, and it doesn't fit me well. I don't like it. So it's very easy for me to personally make that choice. But when it comes to, like, showing my kid music that swears or movies that swear, I will take, you know, if it's there for the sake of art, I'm not going to keep them away from art because there are a couple curse words in it, you know?
Yeah.
So that's how I'm dealing with it.
Well, these are judgment calls, and the tough part in some ways really does come when another family member or a teacher reports, you know, and with dismay and expects you to be dismayed. And it's true that there are many circumstances where you don't want a very young child telling his or her peers to shut up or worse. It's true. But I don't, well, part of it was becoming a dad at the age of 47. I'd already come to certain conclusions about certain issues, both macro, you know, societal and personal, micro. And you know, that doesn't mean that these are unchanging principles founded on, you know, some higher vision of society. I don't think that's true, or if it is, I don't like imposing that on it, because that means someone else is wrong.
Well, no, and that's the thing. I like your style, where you're not going to censor yourself. But for me, where I don't really want to swear that much anyway, I shouldn't swear because I want to raise them like you raise your kids. It's fine. We both fit into our category, and you know, I've talked myself into my way, and I don't think either way, there's no wrong. Well, I take that back. That's yeah. not true. There yeah. is a wrong.
Yeah, there is. I'm not sure what it is, but I tend to think that you know, you don't want a kid who is, you know, foaming at the mouth with racial slurs.
Oh,
I mean, those are things where I think it's important to make the kid aware that they exist, aware of what they are.
Wasn't Jersey parents who named their kid Adolf Hitler?
Well, I mean, yeah, that would be wrong. But I also think telling a kid that you know, it's not okay to use the word hate is probably not going to produce the desired results.
Oh, no, that's it's preposterous. That's it's conflating a word with a thing that actually exists.
And I think there are links there, but there are more links between. Let me put it another way. In terms of parenting in general, you got to pick your battles. Otherwise, the battle is only about control and who's in charge. And unless you really want to turn out some docile, smiley, nicey-nice kid who winds up slaying the entire family one Thanksgiving, you really need to recognize that's an independent human being. That's going to be a grown-up, and you better treat that human being as a potential grown-up, not as some you know, little petri dish for your own feelings of unease with all the hatred in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't put the guilt of an adult on the impressionable mind of a kid and expect them to turn out. They got to make their way through it. But let's use this as a segue, cuz I knew going in today that you wanted to kind of touch on the whole Redskins controversy and Daniel Snyder,
yeah.
the owner of the Redskins. I think yeah. he used the word never going to change the name of the team.
It's interesting because it's directly related, I think, to what we were just talking about. And, of course, I speak as someone with a Chief Wahoo tattooed on his arm. So you have to take it with a huge shaker of salt. I'm not saying that I think that the Redskins name is okey-dokey any more than I think that Chief Wahoo is not a racist caricature. It is a racist caricature.
Mm-hmm.
And the Redskins... clearly an inappropriate name. I think eventually these things will be changed. My issue is with especially the word warriors, you know, the tweeters, the people with whose politics I generally would agree far more than disagree, but who are the same kinds of self-righteous. It really... One of the things that drives a guy like Daniel Snyder, I don't know him, he's by no means admirable from a distance, but one of the things that drives this guy, you know, this rich kid, basically, to the extreme of the never, is that the other side is so shrill and so strident and so smug, and I see the same thing with the Chief Wahoo stuff. These people... The people writing and yammering, that's their entire, in almost every case, that's their entire service to humankind. They kind of remind me of the college kids I saw when I was in grad school having these little sleep outside protest events urging the college to disinvest in any company that did business in South Africa because of their objections, the protesters' objections to apartheid. And that certainly was a loathsome, you know, doomed to the dustbin of history in that iteration of it, a horribly racist thing, worthy of protest. But far be it from any of those students to ever lift a finger or ask mommy or daddy to write a check to any of the third world cities in the United States, not all that far from Iowa City. Far be it from any of these people sitting at their keyboards. Really, they can't be insulting enough toward Dan Snyder. They can't bleed enough ink for the slaughter of the indigenous tribes that were here when the white people came. It must feel so good. You know, I'm sure if they could, just like good Maoists, they would send all the people who don't think correctly to re-education camps, you know, to labor in the field and learn what it's like to be one of the proletariat that they've never known one day of. You know, they're so certain of what everyone else should think and should feel and do that it's kind of hard not to have, for me, to have sympathy for Dan Snyder. Again, this isn't to defend the Redskins' name or the Chief Wahoo image. It's simply to say you need to look in the mirror. As when you're feeling your most self-righteous, maybe that's a time you really ought to look at yourself as closely as you're looking at Dan Snyder. And maybe you ought to think about putting some of that energy or a few dollars toward actually helping people with something other than 140-character tweets.
Well, and even if you don't put actual money toward it, I think there's a huge problem, and you spoke to it with the shrillness and the just how arrogant it is. If you truly want to make a difference and you truly want people to come to your side, you need to make room in the car next to you. You can't sit there and act like it's this exclusive big old thing where you're right and everybody else is wrong, because then nobody can come on your side. You make it impossible.
It happens a lot in the culture. I mean, I think that having survived 8 years of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney is perhaps the purest tribute of my adult life to the resiliency and strength of the United States. So all I'm saying is that the people on the right, for lack of a more complex construction, the people who hated Bill and Hillary Clinton with a hatred that knew no bounds, you know, they killed Vince Foster, they were flying drugs into MENA, all that stuff was very alive during the 8 years of the Clinton presidency. And I thought those people were not just batshit crazy, but made it impossible to have any dialogue that would move the country forward. It was horribly destructive. But I saw the same thing on the other side with George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. And it had nothing to do with politics. It had everything to do with that gut feeling that tells me that here is the face of all evil, and everything that issues forth from these people is pure evil. And let's not have anything resembling a conversation about it, because we're simply talking about evil. And if you don't get that, you're not worth talking to.
Right.
And that, you know, that there's a reason that there's no overall sense of community in the nation. And part of the reason, I don't think it's a symptom or a cause, I think it's both. But part of the reason is that discourse has just become zero sum. I'm right, you're an idiot, and there's nothing for us to talk about.
So back to Daniel Snyder and the Redskins, you do get the sense, and I get the sense with the Indians too, that it's just a matter of time. It gets harder and harder to defend it, and we are on the wrong side of history with it. And that's not me clamoring for the end of Chief Wahoo. Like, I don't know. It seems, man, I'll get in trouble for saying this, but it seems relatively harmless to me at this point. But, you know, I think it will change at some point. I think the Redskins will change at some point. And it'll be a fake controversy. It almost feels like we should just rip the Band-Aid off. And I don't say that as somebody with a tattoo on my arm. So, I mean, is that how you kind of feel we're headed?
Yeah, I don't like to think of myself as an incrementalist, but the reality is that I think the franchise was born in 1932 as the Boston Braves. You know, the fact that they were the last team in professional football to integrate, and that was because, you know, federal officials were urging George Marshall, I think was the general manager of the Skins back back then, were basically telling him not only was it an embarrassment, but it was borderline unlawful to maintain an all-white roster in the National Football League. There is so little. I don't think it really makes a lot of difference whether Chief Wahoo stays or goes. I don't think it makes a lot of difference about the nickname. I think there are much more important, much more central battles to fight in wars, for progress. I think the idea of people spending endless amounts of time and energy basically feigning outrage about these things when there's so much more to be outraged about, so much more to write about. To me, if you're going to focus on sports and injustice and racism, and you're not spending at least 10 times as much energy and writing 10 times as much about college sports and the exploitation and racism and classism that takes place at that level, don't waste my time with this stuff. Yeah, it'll change. It'll change slowly. We're not dealing with back of the bus. We're not dealing with a seat at the lunch counter. We're not dealing with Bull Connor and fire hoses and attack dogs. That doesn't mean it's not meaningful. It just means, have some sense. Stop treating this like you're young Martin Luther King at the keyboard and you have a vision of the mountaintop where there are no team nicknames that insult minorities. It's absurd to me.
All right. Well, I think we've done that topic now.
But have we beaten it to death?
I hope so. Welcome to the WaitingForNextYear.com podcast. It's Monday morning, so I'm talking to Scott Rabb. And before we jumped on, we were talking about how electrified we were by I was talking about how electrified I was by the Tribe this weekend. And you concurred. I don't want to put the word electrified in your mouth, though, Scott.
Yeah, I'm fine with electrified, Craig.
So I was about ready to tell you, I scared the crap out of my 3-year-old yesterday, listening to the Tribe. We had Tom Hamilton on. I was running around doing some errands and, in the ninth inning when they tied the game, and I think Brantley singled to left and Bourne came around third and scored, and I screamed some guttural, yeah, or something like that, and then I turn around and I look at my 3-year-old, and it was that questioning, I think a tear's about to pop out of my face, I'm looking for the next cue from you, Daddy, as to whether I should be upset or scared or both. And I was like, no, it's okay, that was a good thing, it was a good thing. You have to talk them down from weeping and crying.
It is a good thing, and it's a rare thing. Well, I don't know, you may constantly issue, guttural exclamations, but I don't. And one of the first times I made my then infant son burst into tears, he was born in 99, God love him, and I don't remember which playoff Indians team it was, but it was one of those, yes, but it was so loud. It's rare we get a chance to exult in something with a Cleveland team. It was a great series.
And I know he's missed some time, but Michael Bourne, can you just, I mean, I know they made, Reynolds has been a nice pickup and Swisher's been a nice pickup, but trying to imagine how different this season would be if they hadn't come away with that surprising, wonderful move of being able to land Michael Bourne for what many think is less than his market value. But it's still good money, of course, but, I mean, what a coup.
Okay. I don't want to place a turd in that punch bowl of love and excitement. I hope that Michael Bourne, turns out to be a coup. I think his market value was drastically less than Michael Bourne and Michael Bourne's agent felt that it was. I think it was a solid move. Please don't get me wrong. I don't think it will prove to be the crucial free agent acquisition of this past off season. I'm always happy to be wrong. There's nothing wrong with speed on the base paths. There is something wrong with thinking that you can generate it simply by stealing bases. And until Michael Bourne raises his walk rate, my own personal jury is out on Michael Bourne. I think he's a fine center fielder. I think he's a guy that you certainly want on base in the situation that led to you terrifying your poor child. but I'm not huge on Michael Bourne as the straw that could possibly stir the Indians' drink. He's not a guy that you can simply throw bad pitches to and expect him to swing. But you know he strikes out plenty, and I don't know that. You know, he's not on the upside of his career. He's 30 years old, and I know it sounds like I'm just pissing all over poor Michael Bourne. I love what I'm seeing out of the Indians. I'm glad that Bourne's finger healed. He's back in the lineup. I'm watching every inning of every game. Can't wait to see today's doubleheader unfold. I guess don't want to get, you know, I'm a game at a time kind of guy. I don't want to get too high or too low, so I'm sorry if I'm overreacting to your overreaction to the delight in seeing a guy who can actually score from second standing up, you know, on a key base hit.
And I'll admit, I bought into the sales pitch. I guess I'm a bit of a rube to the Indians carny, where they said that it was bonus. You know, they were faced with an extra opportunity to add somebody like Michael Bourne. It was something that they weren't planning on doing, something that wasn't in the financial plan. And to a large extent, I bought that, and my expectations, you know, whether I've been beaten into tempering my expectations or whether I know it's smart business management, maybe I shouldn't care at all. I've tried to talk myself into not caring at all about the Dolan's money or the business sense of being a baseball fan. But I guess in that prism, I talked myself into the fact that Bourne was like bonus. And so now I feel like he's an extra special treat on top of the free agency. So
he is.
But you might not be wrong, is my point.
I'm just saying I don't want to go from extreme to extreme, especially in baseball, where things will unfold for us over the rest of May, all of June, July, August, September. All I'm asking for is a team that I can be interested in, even excited about, you know, for the next 100-plus games. And I think there's nothing wrong with being excited about Michael Bourne. There's nothing to sneeze at to have an above-average center fielder, you know, to have a guy who seems to not just be fast but smart on the bases. We haven't had that. We really haven't. I mean, Sizemore represented the kind of package that all of us could go crazy about, at least for a little while.
Not until Kenny Lofton came back in 2007 as a 40-year-old man.
It's true. And I guess my caveats really are, well, it's always health. Not that Bourne has anything resembling a severe injury history. He's been a full-time player and a productive player, you know, for a while now. I guess, you know, what I worry about more than anything else is keeping the on-base average, you know, at least at 350 if he's batting leadoff. I think it's exactly there right now, making the adjustment, you know, from league to league. It is true that he was hoping for a lot more money than he got from the Indians. I think it's great. I don't even want to go to the bad Dolan place because for whatever reason they laid out the money this year. My concern with the Tribe is not Michael Bourne. It's the thinness of the starting pitching. But game by game by game, I'm not going to disallow you, me, or any other Tribe fan our right to be excited without thinking about necessarily on-base average or how you're going to make it with one or two potential top-of-the-rotation starters, and the rest of them remains to be seen with most of these pitchers, the starters especially.
I think maybe it's because I quit playing fantasy baseball and I just don't know all the names around the league. I'm not an avid watcher of SportsCenter, so I really am Tribe focused. I will know more about the AL Central than the rest of the league. But this is kind of one of the first times in my life where I actually feel that the talent pool is really thinned out in baseball, and that's, I mean, there's no even a concentration of starting pitching in one place where I'm just totally blown away. You see the, in close to you over in Philly, the age is catching up with Doc Halliday and Cliff Lee and that whole staff. And it just seems like we're in one of those in between periods where the talent consolidation doesn't really exist. Even out in Anaheim where they spent all that money, it's on a bunch of guys who are a little bit older. Toronto feels the same way. They bought a really nice fantasy baseball team, but we're talking about a bunch of players that were relative failures last year in Miami. And so it remains to be seen if you could just put, you know, a bunch of guys who are used to getting paid a lot together in their 30s in the post-steroid era, and do anything.
Well, there are, I'm just looking here at baseballreference.com. So there are only 127 games left for the Indians to play. I would suggest, not to disagree entirely with your premise, that when you look at the AL East, when you look at the AL West, I'm talking about the rosters. You look at the Tigers, and I think the NL East too, with the Braves and with the Senators. You know, I mean, there are some really good teams.
And you call them the Senators on purpose, right?
Yeah, no, I didn't. The Nationals. God, okay. You know, I actually remember the Senators.
All I remember is a baseball card with, I think, Duke Snyder. Did he play for the...
Well, he was a Brooklyn Dodger. I don't remember. You know, it's funny. The version of fantasy baseball I play is Diamond Mine Baseball, ImagineSports.com. It's a historical computer-simulated game. You know, based basically on Jamesian principles of sabermetrics.
I've actually never heard of this.
Yeah, it's really good. I mean, so for me, the Senators still exist, and so does Griffith Park. I mean, this is not a plug for Diamond Mine Baseball or Imagine Sports. It's simply the version of fantasy baseball I prefer has nothing to do with the day-to-day unfolding of the major leagues today. It has to do with assembling rosters of players, including Negro League players, Japanese players, so that you can have Satchel Paige, you know, pitching to Babe Ruth. But anyway, that's
well. And you know what's really great about that is that you don't have to care. Why should anybody care about the fifth starter in the Kansas City Royals, except in some, you know, 20 deep fantasy league that's AL only?
It's interesting though. The you're right, but
we could spend our time thinking about Satchel Paige.
Well, but it also it teaches you something, or I like to feel I've learned something about team construction, about allocating money. Since everyone they're you know, dweebs all over the country, mostly of ancient vintage like me, playing against each other, and you each have the same budget going into the season. There's revenue, you know, it's streams that you can alter your roster and make transactions. But part of what it teaches you is how closely related defense and pitching are. If you put a very good defense behind a below average, historically speaking, these are based on the numbers produced by actual major leaguers. They're normalized according to era, blah, blah, blah. But you put a sterling defense behind a below average pitcher, you know, a ground ball pitcher in a ground ball park, that kind of thing. And it really does become clearer and clearer how integrated. And this, by the way, this relates to the tribe. I mean, one of the things that we saw in the Tiger series was kind of a combination of errors that just, you know, I'm sure made you want to scream loud enough to frighten the kid again. You know, because if Chisenhall can't get the throw over to Santana, Santana's no kind of first baseman. But along with that, the Indians really have assembled quite an outfield defense. They really have, and are strong up the middle. I think despite some of the metrics, I think Cabrera is a very able shortstop, sometimes spectacular. Like on that double play ball yesterday that could have easily resulted in no outs, he reached behind his body, got the poor relay, and got enough on the throw to first. But anyway, it's great to see the Indians with more than the semblance of a major league lineup. I guess part of my Michael Bourne issue is not even a Michael Bourne issue. It's a Mark Reynolds issue. If there has been a huge acquisition in terms of what we've seen over the first 35 games, it's that, yeah, this guy Reynolds, he's versatile defensively, and he's not a hole at first or at third. And boy, is he a surprise to me so far with the bat. He's not the all-or-nothing 220 strikeout guy, or he's not merely that. He seems to have some bat control and some savvy and a plan when he's got a couple of strikes on him and they need a hit.
It was a real find for the Indians in free agency, because he's turned out to be everything that Indians fans were thinking they might be able to scratch out of Kevin Youkilis last year at the trade deadline.
Sure, that's great. That's a great comparison. You're right.
And so, it's funny because I'm just enjoying it. I'm enjoying watching him just be a slugger and hit monstrous home runs and contribute to the team. Some people are already worrying about the fact that he's going to be gone in an extension and everything else. Just please, you know, I can't tell anybody what to think or do, but please just forget about it. Let him drive us somewhere first.
It's tough. It really is. It's tough to be so conditioned. I am, certainly, to worst-case scenarios, and to not enjoy, don't ever enjoy the moment. If it's any given game, you know that they'll snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory somehow. And if they don't, let's get worried anyway, because, yeah, Reynolds is just he's only signed for this year. And it was, however things turn out, that was a nice, solid, savvy move for a team that's been moaning for a couple of seasons, at least, about a lack of right-handed hitting. This guy is just a delight to watch at the plate so far.
Yeah, absolutely. So today, the traditional doubleheader against the Yankees, you outwardly hate the Yankees as much as anybody I've ever talked to. Is there a complete history, or is it just incremental as to why you hate the Yankees so much? Does it boil down to a couple things, or is it just that incremental path?
Well, it was always there. I mean, it was there as a kid. The few games I remember my dad taking me to in Cleveland were Yankees games at a time when Cleveland was really, really competitive, talking about the late 50s. It wasn't a general New York hatred at all. I guess it was incipient in the sense of it's not genetic, but it's pretty close to that. I know I loved Mickey Mantle as a ball player. You know, there was nothing to me more appealing than the idea of this switch hitting guy fighting through his injury. So that Yankee was all right with me. There wasn't anyone in particular that I focused any loathing on until Jeter came along, by which time, I'm not sure where I was living. I've been living in northern New Jersey since 1996, surrounded by Yankees fans, and have become friends with some. Not all of them take credit, you know, for the 27 world championships. Not all of them refer constantly to we, you know, as if they actually had something to do
right
with it. So part of what's happened, you know, the hatred exists in some platonic realm, some intellectual realm, and I've had this up-close seat since the great Joe Torre years, kind of being forced to admire the Yankees. It's kind of similar to the Steelers, except for the total lack of economic balance in baseball, which really does load up the hatred side. At the same time, it's become impossible for me not to admire the organizations. They make more than their share of mistakes because they spend more of their share of money, but they've homegrown some really enjoyable ball players. Mariano Rivera right now. I mean, I can't watch Mariano Rivera and not accept the fact that the guy, very likable and also the best, one of the best major league pitchers, period, that I've ever seen.
See, and that's funny. I was going to say the best relief pitcher I've ever seen in my entire life, and I'm probably being offensive when I qualify it that way, because you're right. I mean, in terms of dominance, in terms of longevity and effectiveness over a long period of time, I mean, I hate to sound like, you know, guy who loves the Yankees, but there's nothing not to like about Mariano Rivera.
No, and there's no way to argue. I don't think the defensive metrics lie about Jeter's lack of range. But, you know, all that aside, it's, you know, to not see this guy as a first ballot Hall of Famer. They boiled down at one point to when they were tearing down Yankee Stadium. I had made sure that my son's first two or three Major League Baseball in-person experiences were at the Jake. I always told him he was free to find any team he wanted to root for in any sport. He wasn't born in Cleveland, but he could not, under any circumstances, become a Yankees fan. And one of the first phrases that he ever used coherently was, "Fuck Derek Jeter." But I took him to Yankee Stadium one game before they tore it down, one of the last home games the Yankees played in the old Yankee Stadium, because I didn't want to deny him the experience of seeing a Yankees game in Yankee Stadium. So I've come to grudgingly respect or accept certain aspects of their goodness, their you know, their professionalism, whatever you want to call it, while I continue to innately hate them.
Let's diverge a little bit there, because you just hit on something that I've thought about a lot since becoming a dad, and I've got a 3-year-old and you've got a 13-year-old. How do you treat, because you're a guy who's free with your language, how do you treat, you know, quote, vulgar language around your kids? And how did you have a philosophy about that when you're, you know, around him and teaching him to speak? Because I think at around 1 year old, our pediatrician said, "All right, well, it's time to start watching your mouth around the kid, because he's going to start parroting you."
I would change pediatricians. I mean, my feeling, and I've gotten in trouble with it, but it's also, I guess, one of the ways, not to sound too grandiose, one of the ways I make my living is by thinking about words a lot, obsessively. And this goes for racial slurs. It goes for vulgarities. The words exist. I have family members, people whom I respect, who, if their kid goes, "God, I hate broccoli," the parent's response is, "We don't use that word. Not broccoli. Hate."
I got in trouble. I was spoken to about the fact that my kid said, "Shut up."
Yeah.
And at daycare, you know, they call it a school now. Nothing could be a daycare. Nothing could be a child, you know, a place where they watch your kids. It's a school. It's a school, because I think it justifies more money.
And every toy is developmental.
Yep. Right.
Rubber ball is developmental.
So I obsess about things. I'm crazy like that. So I started going through, and I knew for a fact that it was in a book. And I'm just trying to place where exactly he learned how to say "shut up." And it's the Lorax. It's the stupid law. It's the Lorax, Dr.
Yeah.
Seuss. Okay.
Yeah.
And here I'm getting spoken to that my son said the word "shut up," and they complimented. They said he used it in context. He used it correctly.
The same way my son uses "cocksucker." He knows when to deploy it and where to deploy it. Here's my general feeling about these things. We need society and we need civilization in order to live lives, you know, relatively free from all the horrors of, you know, Darwinian existence, where it's dog eat dog, except it's humans eating humans. I do believe that, you know, in general, a society needs structure. I have a harder time accepting the fact that structure tends to want to smooth and polish and shape and make rules and have thought police and word police. And I know these are abstract concepts to the child free, but when you have a kid, suddenly these become big issues. You know, what do you call a bowel movement? When can you say "shut up" or use the word "hate"? How do you deal with, you know, issues of words that are perceived as utterly forbidden? You know, no civilized person can say the N-word. No young child should hurl an F-bomb, and on and on and on. I tend to constantly err on the side of the hell with that and those rules. These words exist. They exist for a reason. They have tremendous power or not. And, you know, you teach more by modeling the behavior than by didactically imposing rules upon the child. And I've always made mistakes in the direction of, it's nice to call it free speech, but let's just call it potty mouth. That's because they're the same thing when it comes to the home situation. So I'm certainly not holding myself out as an example to anyone. It's simply some congruence between my overall philosophy of using language and my practice of using language. More is more.
I don't disagree with you. A lot of what you just said is very similar to what Kevin Smith said too. Because, you know, when he has a daughter, and he said on the record, you know, in some interview I heard, and he said, "What kind of a hypocrite would I be if I kept all that language away from my daughter when that's really how I created the entire life that I've built?" The whole, you know, he was doing dick jokes and talking about God knows what in Clerks. For me personally, I don't feel this overarching need to speak that way. I've tried to write using vulgarity in the past, and it doesn't fit me well. I don't like it. So it's very easy for me to personally make that choice. But when it comes to like showing my kid music that swears or movies that swear, I will take, you know, if it's there for the sake of art, I'm not going to keep him away from art because there are a couple curse words in it, you know?
Yeah.
So that's how I'm dealing with it.
Well, these are judgment calls. And the tough part in some ways really does come when another family member or a teacher reports, you know, and with dismay and expects you to be dismayed. And it's true that there are many circumstances where you don't want a young child, a very young child, telling his or her peers to shut up. Or it's true. But I don't. Well, part of it was becoming a dad at the age of 47. I'd already come to certain conclusions about certain issues, both macro, you know, societal and personal, micro. And you know, that doesn't mean that these are unchanging principles founded on, you know, some higher vision of society. I don't think that's true. Or if it is, I don't like imposing that on it, because that means someone else is wrong.
Well, no, and that's the thing. I like your style where you're not going to censor yourself. But for me, where I don't really want to swear that much anyway, I shouldn't swear because I want to raise them like you raise your kids. It's fine. We both fit into our category, and you know, I've talked myself into my way, and I don't think either way there's no wrong. Well, I take that back. That's yeah. Not true. There is a wrong.
Yeah, there is. I'm not sure what it is, but I tend to think that you know, you don't want a kid who is you know, foaming at the mouth with racial slurs.
I mean,
those are things where I think it's important to make the kid aware that they exist, aware of what they are.
Wasn't Jersey parents who named their kids Adolf Hitler?
Well, I mean, yeah, that would be wrong. But I also think telling a kid that you know, it's not okay to use the word hate is probably not going to produce the desired results.
No, that's it's preposterous. That's it's conflating a word with a thing that actually exists.
And I think there are links there, but there are more links between. Let me put it another way. In terms of parenting in general, you got to pick your battles. Otherwise, the battle is only about control and who's in charge. And unless you really want to turn out some docile, smiley, nicey, nice kid who winds up slaying the entire family one Thanksgiving, you really need to recognize that's an independent human being. That's going to be a grown-up, and you better treat that human being as a potential grown-up, not as some little petri dish for your own feelings of unease with all the hatred in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't put the guilt of an adult on the impressionable mind of a kid and expect them to turn out. They got to make their way through it. But let's use this as a segue, because I knew going in today that you wanted to kind of touch on the whole Redskins controversy and Daniel Snyder, the owner of the Redskins. I think he used the word never going to change the name of the team.
It's interesting because it's directly related, I think, to what we were just talking about. And, of course, I speak as someone with the Chief Wahoo tattooed on his arm. So you have to take it with a huge shaker of salt. I'm not saying that I think that the Redskins name is okie-dokie any more than I think that Chief Wahoo is not a racist caricature. It is a racist caricature.
Mm-hmm.
And the Redskins, clearly an inappropriate name. I think eventually these things will be changed. My issue is with especially the word warriors, you know, the tweeters, the people with whose politics I generally would agree far more than disagree, but who are the same kinds of self-righteous. It really, one of the things that drives a guy like Daniel Snyder, I don't know him, he's by no means admirable from a distance, but one of the things that drives this guy, you know, this rich kid, basically, to the extreme of the never, is that the other side is so shrill and so strident and so smug, and I see the same thing with the Chief Wahoo stuff. These people, the people writing and yammering, that's their entire, in almost every case, that's their entire service to humankind. They kind of remind me of the college kids I saw when I was in grad school having these little sleep outside protest events, urging the college to disinvest in any company that did business in South Africa because of their objections, the protesters' objections to apartheid. And that certainly was a loathsome, you know, doomed to the dustbin of history in that iteration of it, a horribly racist thing, worthy of protest. But far be it from any of those students to ever lift a finger or ask mommy or daddy to write a check to any of the third world cities in the United States, not all that far from Iowa City. Far be it from any of these people sitting at their keyboards, really, they can't be insulting enough toward Dan Snyder. They can't bleed enough ink for the slaughter of the indigenous tribes that were here when the white people came. It must feel so good. You know, I'm sure if they could, just like good Maoists, they would send all the people who don't think correctly to re-education camps. You know, to labor in the field and learn what it's like to be one of the proletariat that they've never known one day of. You know, they're so certain of what everyone else should think and should feel and do that it's kind of hard not to have, for me, to have sympathy for Dan Snyder. Again, this isn't to defend the Redskins name or the Chief Wahoo image. It's simply to say you need to look in the mirror as when you're feeling your most self-righteous. Maybe that's a time you really ought to look at yourself as closely as you're looking at Dan Snyder. And maybe you ought to think about putting some of that energy or a few dollars toward actually helping people with something other than 140-character tweets.
Well, and even if you don't put actual money toward it, I think there's a huge problem, and you spoke to it with the shrillness and the just how arrogant it is. If you truly want to make a difference and you truly want people to come to your side, you need to make room in the car next to you. You can't sit there and act like it's this exclusive big old thing where you're right and everybody else is wrong, because then nobody can come on your side. You make it impossible.
It happens a lot in the culture. I mean, I think that having survived 8 years of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney is perhaps the purest tribute of my adult life to the resiliency and strength of the United States. So all I'm saying is that the people on the right, for lack of a more complex construction, the people who hated Bill and Hillary Clinton with a hatred that knew no bounds, you know, they killed Vince Foster, they were flying drugs in Tamina. All that stuff was very alive during the 8 years of the Clinton presidency, and I thought those people were not just batshit crazy, but made it impossible to have any dialogue that would move the country forward. It was horribly destructive, But I saw the same thing on the other side with George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. And it had nothing to do with politics. It had everything to do with that gut feeling that tells me that here is the face of all evil, and everything that issues forth from these people is pure evil. And let's not have anything resembling a conversation about it, because we're simply talking about evil. And if you don't get that, you're not worth talking to.
Right.
And that, you know, that there's a reason that there's no overall sense of community in the nation. And part of the reason, I don't think it's a symptom or a cause, I think it's both. But part of the reason is that discourse has just become zero sum. I'm right, you're an idiot, and there's nothing for us to talk about.
So, and when it comes, so back to Daniel Snyder and the Redskins, you do get the sense, and I get the sense with the Indians too, that it's just a matter of time. It gets harder and harder to defend it, and we are on the wrong side of history with it. And that's not me clamoring for the end of Chief Watt. Like, I don't know. It seems, man, I'll get in trouble for saying this, but it seems relatively harmless to me at this point. But, you know, I think it will change at some point. I think the Redskins will change at some point. And it'll be a fake controversy. It almost feels like we should just rip the Band-Aid off. And I don't say that as somebody with a tattoo on my arm. So, I mean, is that how you kind of feel we're headed?
Yeah, I don't like to think of myself as an incrementalist, but the reality is that I think the franchise was born in 1932 as the Boston Braves. You know, the fact that they were the last team in professional football to integrate, and that was because, you know, federal officials were urging George Marshall, I think was the general manager of the Skins back then, you know, were basically telling him not only was it embarrassment, but it was borderline unlawful to maintain an all-white roster in the National Football League. There is so little... I don't think it really makes a lot of difference whether, you know, Chief Wahoo stays or goes. I don't think it makes a lot of difference about the nickname. I think there are much more important, much more central battles to fight in wars, you know, for progress. I think the idea of people spending endless amounts of time and energy basically feigning outrage about these things when there's so much more to be outraged about, so much more to write about. You know, the to me, if you're going to focus on sports and injustice and racism, and you're not spending at least 10 times as much energy and writing 10 times as much about college sports and the exploitation and racism and classism that takes place at that level, don't waste my time with this stuff. Yeah, it'll change. It'll change slowly. We're not dealing with back of the bus. We're not dealing with a seat at the lunch counter. We're not dealing with Bull Connor and fire hoses and attack dogs. It doesn't mean it's not meaningful. It just means, you know, have some sense. Stop treating this like you're young Martin Luther King at the keyboard and you have a vision of the mountaintop where there are no team nicknames that insult minorities. It's absurd to me.
All right. Well, I think we've done that topic now,
But have we beaten it to death?
I hope so. I hope so.
So I
back to Cleveland sports. Armani Bryant, never has a seventh round pick been talked about so much, probably in the history of Cleveland Browns football. The guy who got popped for selling weed to an undercover twice. Gets drafted in the seventh round. You can't argue with that. Taking chances on guys who fell down the board for off the field stuff is a great, seventh round is a great time to take chances on guys like that. So then he gets popped the week after he gets drafted with a DUI. Terry Pluto, who a respected columnist entitled to his opinion, says that there's no place for this guy on the Browns and they
right.
shouldn't even
no
bother
place.
Bringing him in.
No, there's no place in Terry Pluto's world for this guy.
Well, okay. And so the Browns bring him in, and I respect Terry Pluto's opinion, and I could have justified, I mean, I don't know the guy, so I've never talked to him, I've never been around him, but if the Browns had cut him before rookie camp, I could have stood by that. There's a you can't argue with it, right?
Yeah, I think you can argue with it. Why would you cut the guy before rookie camp? Why would you do that?
Well, I mean, maybe the DUI is the straw that broke the camel's back. They presumably have talked to the guy and interviewed the guy, and then if he just was a total hypocrite, you know, maybe there is no place in a rookie class for a guy like that from the seventh round.
Well, not on the Pluto Choir boys, apparently. I like Terry Pluto. I admire Terry Pluto, but the next time Terry Pluto surprises me with something, with an opinion, will be the first time Terry Pluto surprises me with an opinion. I mean, I'm not positing myself as having any higher insight into morality than Terry Pluto, who writes, as I'm sure you're aware, a religion or spirituality column, and who has had his own struggles with issues. I don't think they were related to alcohol or to other drugs, but, you know, has found some degree of you know, safety and not to say sanctimony in religion, and who maybe has a vision of putting together a team, a football team, an organization that doesn't have room for more than you know, a couple of chances, whatever you know, this guy turns out to be.
Well, let's remove it from Terry Pluto. Do you think the Steelers would maybe cut a seventh rounder because of their history?
No, I because their history would certainly depend on their history. You know, I think if they believed in, well, part of it, of course, is always the context of we're Cleveland fans talking about a particular draft choice in a draft where, for the most part, the Browns preferred, it was the Bartleby draft, the Bartleby, the Scrivener draft. They would prefer not to. Let everyone else draft. We'll wait till next year. So part of it is that Bryant kind of stands out as a case that we can dwell on, because there's so little else to dwell on right now. I noticed that there wasn't any hue and cry, including in Terry Pluto's column, about Quentin Groves. Apparently, there's some huge difference between a guy soliciting a prostitute who turned out to be a policewoman and a guy who clearly has some issues with substances. So the first one's okay, Quentin Groves. I didn't hear any outcry. Maybe it's the matter of offenses or the nature of the offense, but the guy's not accused anything worse than DUI. I think selling weed in the quantities he was apparently selling it is a relatively victimless crime. It may speak to the guy's lack of intelligence. And saying he's a hypocrite, I guess, is okay, because he pledged that he would turn it around. But the idea of the team suddenly deciding that there's no place in this organization for a young kid who clearly is no genius. You know, I don't know that he got a degree. I don't really haven't done any research, but they have. He could apparently play football. I don't have any problem with them welcoming him to training camp and checking out the goods that they chose to draft in the seventh round. I just don't see the issue here. Honest.
Yeah, I guess. And that's kind of where I was, too. Bring him to rookie camp if he's every bit as bad as some people are projecting on him right now, they'll cut him at the end of the week. It's no problem.
Yeah,
it'll cost him a flight.
But this is again one of the things you're left with as a Cleveland fan, is that it's a draft where really, how many picks did they they got McFadden, they got the Barkevious.
It was five total picks, right, out of seven.
Yeah, five total picks. We can talk about best, you know, we talk about free agents, we talk about a lot of things, but this is the guy who's been in the news for all the wrong reasons. But I don't think this is symptomatic of some Lombardi problem or Banner Lombardi. You know, it's a seventh round draft pick who's screwing up. Let's see what he looks like.
Yeah. Okay. So the big Cleveland story this week was not a sports story. The kidnapped victims.
What are you talking about? Oh, those kidnapped. Oh, yeah. The media porn circus moved from Boston to Cleveland this week. Yeah, I saw that.
How crazy was that? I couldn't believe they were camped outside her house when she was going home. I thought that was just perverse.
I can't believe that the entire broadcast world now is the Maury Povich show. People are just apparently
complete
waiting.
With the "he is not the father" moment, or "he is the
right.
father" in this case.
No, I mean this is. If this is not pornography, then there's no such thing as pornography. The worst part of it for me, and I'm not even going to address the real worst part, which is how do these young women go ahead and live the rest of it? I can't even speculate about that because you hope that somehow people have the resiliency and the resources and the support to somehow move along and achieve, you know, some degree of normalcy, whatever normalcy means. But for me, the most awful part in the global sense is not only have I been talking about this all week on and off the air, but this will be a defining event for my hometown, you know, your hometown, for Cleveland, for a decade, if not more. This is one of the things that people are going to think about every time they hear Cleveland. And I'm not suggesting the news media shouldn't have covered it. I'm saying the way they covered it could not have been more disgusting, more prurient, and more awful. It's just in every way one of the most revolting examples of what news, in quotes, what news coverage has become.
Can you help me work something out? So the one thing that bothered me the most, and I really, you know, I followed it on Twitter. I really wasn't watching TV coverage of the event. I was trying not to, but every time they were covering it blow by blow, minute by minute, and all the news organizations, I don't think it was just one channel. I think it was all three channels in the Cleveland area had branded the story on Twitter with a hashtag #MiracleInCLE. And there was just something about taking it to that level where they branded it with a hashtag online that it felt, and I tried to talk myself through it, you know, all right, well, they're calling it a miracle. So is it really so bad? I mean, these girls are alive and everybody likes a feel good story. That's not like death porn. It's happiness, you know, it's a happy story. So I was trying to talk myself through it. Tell me why. Can you tell me why I was so bothered by that?
I'm not sure if, well, I'm guessing it was some combination of the happy face, you know, the miracle. You know, there's something with the juxtaposition of, you know, miracle, because after all, you know, these young women were found alive and in relatively decent physical condition many years after you know, families could have written them off as dead. It's unimaginable to have a child, you know, go missing like that. That part is miraculous on an individual basis.
And I know myself, I would have said for sure in my own mind if that had been one of my family members that they were dead.
Yeah, I mean, you have to, whatever your faith in a higher power or in anything else, there would not be a moment on any day of your life where that hole, you know, that pain was not front and center. And along with that would be the thought of you're never going to see that person again. That part of it, I think, you know, that might merit the hashtag miracle in CLE. And that's a very powerful thing. To have it coexist with the endless, and I mean endless, I wasn't tuned in to channels 3, 5, 8, or 19. You know,
right.
I'm watching to the extent I can tolerate it. I'm watching CNN. I'm watching MSNBC. I watch Fox too, but you know, Fox never loses its focus on the anti-Obama talking points. Not that they didn't cover the story, but to
CNN was really big locally too, and it seemed like all the local newscasters were looking for their moment on CNN.
Pathetic. And one of the horrible parts of that is, forget the miracle. I mean, because all that CNN was primarily concerned about was trying to walk that tightrope between, you know, how many horrible details, you know, how granular can we get sexually, in terms of what the women were subjected to. It had nothing to do with the miracle, and everything to do with the worst parts, the most, again, prurient parts of the story. And then it just feeds into this, and you know it in a general sense from, you know, how porn-driven the Internet is.
Wait a minute, you're telling me you didn't need to know that the baby was delivered in a kiddie pool instead of a bathtub?
On and on and on, and how many miscarriages, and how, you know.
I don't mean to laugh. I'm sorry. I just laughed.
No, but that's you can slap the hashtag on it, but when all you're doing is basically teasing people with, I mean, it's an insult to tabloids to even call only TV, only the insatiable news cycle could latch on so fiercely to that aspect of the story and just milk it day after day after day. It, you know, it's not garden variety stuff because the women did turn out to be relatively safe and all that. So it is miraculous in that sense, but it's a horror show, and it's, I don't want to get too weird about it or with the 9/11 stuff because, you know, there are places all over the world where buildings collapse, you know, without any planes flying into them, and scores of people are killed. But when the American media, broadcast media, get a hold of stuff like this, or they fetishize 9/11, they've been doing that forever, and this became so over the top and fetishized that it became impossible to digest. The fact that it happened in Cleveland, it doesn't make it any worse, except to people with some positive attachment to the city. But they would have done the same anywhere, and it would have been just as revolting.
And meanwhile, you know, why should this story scare the crap out of people who don't live anywhere near Cleveland? Part of the reason that, you know, kids aren't free to go play outside and all over the country is because, you know, this national, when we get one of these big stories and we popularize it, all of a sudden everybody from New Jersey to Texas to California is worried about the same thing that was an isolated incident that happened in, you know, a specific neighborhood in Cleveland. And nationalizing those stories just leads to a certain culture that is kind of artificial, really.
Well, in some ways it mirrors the earlier part of the conversation about, you know, how do you prepare your kids to live in the world? In this case, not linguistically. I don't know whether, in truth, things like this happened less frequently. I know for a fact that people did not hear about them as frequently. So when it comes time for my kid to walk to school, you know, in the third grade, yeah, we might live in a better neighborhood in terms of median income, but that doesn't mean the stuff can't happen. You know, it's like lightning and fire in the home and all that stuff doesn't only happen to other people or to poor people, or, you know, it happens. And you have to say to the kid, yeah, you could walk to school, but under no circumstances fill in the blank, you know, get into a car. I don't care if they know your name. I don't, you know, while it's true that most of these things, abductions, for example, I think statistically are far more likely to be someone well known to the child or to the family, not this kind of thing where a stranger is offering, you know, girls a ride home and the girls are never seen again.
Well, and I think one of the girls was, she knew his real daughter.
Yes.
So it was like, yes. it was, where he consciously made a connection with the girl over the daughter. But
you can't, the schools teach this and the parents teach it.
Right.
You know, how do you not terrify your child? How do you live as a parent? how do you live with some sense of serenity, not in fear every moment? And those are really tough questions to answer.
Yeah, I'll let you know. I'll have to try and muddle my way through. Everything seems much easier right now with a 3-year-old because, he's always pretty much within eyesight.
Yep.
But
things get complicated, and that's where, even cell phones get complicated because, what's too young to have a cell phone? Well, to my way of thinking, and this was a family kind of decision, if he's walking to school by himself, he's old enough in third grade to have a cell phone. I want the kid to have a cell phone. If he's walking, a half mile, three quarters of a mile, to school in a really busy street for a suburb, most of the way, the kid gets a cell phone. I need to be able to reach him. He needs to be able to reach me.
Yeah. And I laugh at all the people who have like artificial rules, like they're trying to impose some, if we don't let our kid have a cell phone until he's 16, we'll make him more normal. Like, I don't know. Pragmatism must rule the day in my world.
And normal, I think everyone gets to define that.
Yeah,
I don't think your definition. Speaking generally, any you gets to define my normalcy.
That's a very good point. Last but not least, I kind of wanted to end on a lighter note. Brian Spaeth and I have been doing the Summer Movie Podcast, and this week I was not looking forward to The Great Gatsby at all. But I went and saw it, and it was okay. It just left me wondering if they should ever really make, and I know it's an old topic, the book is better than the movie, and should you ever make a movie out of the book? But the more people clamor for a story, the more well-known the story is, it seems the less likely they should actually make it.
Yeah, I'm kind of open to it. Gatsby, I'll see it eventually. There are very few. Most of the time when I go to the movies in person, it's a screening because I'm working on something for Esquire. And so I go to a screening. I'm either by myself or with a few other people, and I'll see half a dozen or a dozen movies a year that way. It's very rare that my wife and I, or the three of us anymore, or that me and my kid go to see a first-run movie. We're busy. But I'll see this eventually. I've seen, I think, two other attempts at filming Gatsby. I'm not much of a purist. There's a great novel called Winter's Bone. Certainly not of the stature of Gatsby, but I was thinking about it because it's a great movie. I saw the movie first.
I like that movie too.
It's a really first-rate movie. And it's a really first-rate novel. And probably more faithful, and can be more faithful to the book than it's possible in terms of Gatsby. But I don't have some de facto issue with people trying to make a really good movie out of a really good book. They're such different experiences, and I think that there's something magical in totally different ways about each medium. I think it's kind of cool. I really, the older I get, the more resistant I am to hard and fast positions, especially when it comes to cultural products. I don't snark that much anymore. I'm more open, I think, than I've ever been to crap. To just enjoying crap. I don't know that the new Gatsby is crap. I think it's hilarious that it's 3D. That seems funny to me.
Yeah.
And not in a series. I don't think it was made that way in order to be funny. I think, the appeal to an entirely new generation. Whatever Lerman was trying to do, I expect you saw it, right?
I watched it at 10 o'clock in Chagrin Falls at the Chagrin Cinema with, I think, six high school girls.
Did you? But
I was by myself.
They weren't with you?
No.
Oh, so that.
Thankfully for my wife, no.
But did you like it?
I didn't hate it. I mean,
wait a second. Those are two very different things.
I enjoyed it. And like you, I'm not so crazy. I've got time, my expectations vary, I like movies, so I enjoyed it. But when it comes time to tell everybody what I thought, I can't tell them that it's a 10. It's, it's a mediocre movie.
It's such a great small novel, really a novella. And I used to read it once a year. I haven't read it in a few years. It's such a pristine piece of work that I think some of its essence is not let's put it this way, impossible to capture some of what makes that book beautiful. But the idea that therefore you shouldn't try, or that I'm going to go, that I'm never going to see it, with the kind of attitude, how dare they? You know, I do. I like movies. There are a lot of movies I don't like, but I like the idea of movies, and I like making decisions. I do this with books too. If I'm not enjoying something, I won't keep reading it, and I won't keep watching it.
When did you start doing that? Because that's a revelation for me in the last 3 or 4 years that I don't have to finish something.
I think probably within the last 10 or so years where I've simply said, and more with books than with movies.
Does it correspond to your kid and you running out of personal free time?
It corresponds with that and with age. When I still buy books, but I have enough books. You know, if I live a good and healthy life for the next 25 years, which is unlikely because I'm 60, I think I have enough books because I do revisit many books, and I do spend a lot of time reading, far more than I spend watching movies. We watched Silver Linings Playbook, by the way. I had seen it in a screener because I was going to interview Bradley Cooper back before it came out, but my wife and son hadn't seen it. It was the first romantic comedy I think our son really enjoyed.
And I saw that one twice, by the way, because I watched it without my wife, and then I had to watch it with her, and I really liked it.
Yeah, basically the same thing, but I really liked it both times, and there are things not to like about the movie. There are things,
sure.
You know, I read a review in The New Yorker by a reviewer who normally I just can't stand, David Denby, really didn't like the movie at all. You know, but the truth of the matter is when I went to see the movie Gangs of New York, after about half hour, 40 minutes, I left the theater. And that, whenever that came out, that's within the past 10 years.
See, this is scary because I turned that one off too.
They're just, for whatever reason, I just don't feel like wasting the time and wasting the emotion of engaging with a movie or a book when there are others I can move on to. And it's really that simple.
Yeah, even ones that other people consider worse, I'll find some more enjoyment out of, just whether it's based on a mood or a style, or I can pick up on small things, and then other times a complete work will just lose me.
I'm perfectly fine with that. I read and listen to what other people have to say, but I don't consider anyone very authoritative. And it always reminds me of one of Bobcat Goldthwait's movies. I think his first directorial effort, Shakes the Clown, about an alcoholic clown. I've actually written about it, you know, short stuff for Esquire. I love that movie. That movie is so deeply and widely dismissed as just a piece of crap. But I think it's a really fun, I think it has one of the best openings of any comedy I've ever seen. I'm not saying that there's something great about it, but it's such a fun movie for me, at least. And it's just an example of, you know, okay, anyone who's actually seen the movie, by and large, dislikes the movie, thinks it's a total waste of time. I've seen it a lot. I like it.
Well, and Bobcat and you kind of get the last laugh, because his latest round of films have been really good.
Well, but a lot of people feel otherwise. I think that last movie was God Bless America.
That was awesome.
I loved it. Again,
it was so dark.
Yeah, and that movie, if you look at, I think, boxofficemojo.com, that movie grossed a couple $100,000. It didn't play anywhere.
Right.
But I'm simply saying that these are movies that they don't get any of the respect or kind of the offbeat reverence accorded to whatever independent film means. But these are purely independent films that they don't get any acclaim whatsoever, and nobody's ever going to see them unless they look really hard for them, and that's okay too.
Well, and I dipped my toes in that just briefly recently because I don't want to say too much, but Brian's made a film. So
is he done?
He's editing.
That's great. Brian Spaeth, you talk about it. You know, this is one of the things that kills me about Cleveland. I'm not even talking about me, because, you know, I'm not a filmmaker. I'm a magazine writer. I wrote a book, blah, blah, blah. But when people like Brian come back to Cleveland, you know, they're from the area, they come back to Cleveland, not enough people know about Brian. Brian's a perfect example of a guy that Cleveland can't afford to lose. More people should know about him. You know, I think of guys like Harvey Pekar. I'm not comparing Brian to anyone. My favorite Cleveland writer, John Heidhook, who works in a beverage warehouse, you know, got basically downsized by the alternative weeklies in Cleveland. It's very tough for any quote-unquote artist to make a living in Cleveland. But what adds to that burden is this sense of, well, if you're here, you must suck. Cleveland really has internalized a lot of the worst of its self-image. And there is a certain, not only lack of pride, but the reverse of pride, a certain sense that, you know, we're losers from Loserville, and if you haven't gotten out, you must not really be that good at whatever it is you're doing. And the arts in particular I'm talking about. And I'm really glad to hear that Brian's moving along with that, because, you know, it's tough to write something, you know, to complete something, but it's a lot tougher because of the nature of the process to actually complete any kind of movie.
Yes. Yes. Well, and hope it's going to be up to.
And my dog agrees.
I was just going to say it's going to be up to me and guys like you to, you know, beyond language and raising our kids with that stuff is raising kids with the self-image of Cleveland in this area, that it doesn't have. Red Sox fans weren't defined by 1918 if they were born in 1979 like I was. And, you know, my kid doesn't have to be defined by John Elway.
You know, here's something that people, I think it's true. People don't understand that the fact that none of those teams has won a title in 50 years actually makes a huge difference, because it has become very easy, and I think it's true to say, that the last vestige of Cleveland as a major American city are the existence of the Browns, Cavaliers, and the Tribe. This is the thing, this is what's left that makes people elsewhere conscious of Cleveland as a big city, and makes Clevelanders conscious of themselves as a big city. I don't think there are that many other things you can point to. That's not to dismiss the greatness of the orchestra, which I saw play in Miami, where they do a winter residence every year. Miami has no orchestra. Mm-hmm. They import the Cleveland Orchestra. Anyway, what I'm saying is, if one of those teams were to win a championship, it actually would make a difference, not just to you or to me, but to your kid and to my kid and to every kid in Cleveland. It would make a difference. People would be more proud to be from Cleveland, and it would change. Even one title in any of those sports would absolutely change not just the image, but the self-image of Cleveland, Ohio.
I agree. And we've set a record. I think we've gone the longest we've ever gone. But this was a great conversation today.
I hope. Well, that's not up to us to judge, Craig.
Well, I enjoyed it, and it's up to me to say that I enjoyed it.
I appreciate it. I did, too.
All right. So I'll catch you next week. This has been the WaitingForNextYear.com podcast.
The Korean War has sadly been known as the Forgotten War, but half a century earlier, the United States was locked in a bloody conflict in Asia that's been all but erased from the history books. Hi, I'm Alex Hasty, the host of Ohio vs. the World, an American history podcast on the Evergreen Podcast Network. In our newest episode, we speak to experts about the Philippine-American War, America's first Asian counterinsurgency conflict. The heroes, the villains. We'll discuss President McKinley, Admiral Dewey, the vicious brutality of the fighting, and the scandals and war crimes that nearly sunk Theodore Roosevelt's presidency. Check out our show, Ohio vs. the World, on the Evergreen Podcast Network for our new episode about America's most forgotten war. Now back to the show.